Okay, so good afternoon, and thank you, Valérie, and thank you also to Patrick and Barbara for inviting me. I really enjoyed the 2 days that I spent here and the presentations. So I change a bit the title compared to what you find in the program. I will summarize the results that we have obtained in the last few years on surface wave anisotropy, but I will also speak a bit about seismic attenuation. Okay, so this work has been done with a lot of colleagues. And before to start, I just want to acknowledge them. So Alice Adoni is my PhD student. She has been working on the quality factor. She has built the Q model that you will see in this presentation. Fabien Dubuffet and Yannick Krucard are not students, but they have been involved in the building of the shear wave velocity model. They are in Lyon. Stéphanie Durand in Munster has been also involved in the building of the SV velocity model. And for the SH model and the radial anisotropy, we have done that in collaboration with a group in Cambridge, and especially TACPO, who's a PhD student. So let me start with a quite old model. This model was published 25 years ago by Jean-Paul Montagnier and Tanimoto. And it's probably the first tomographic model that included, at the same time, the SV wave azimuthal anisotropy, the SV wave heterogeneities, and also the radial anisotropy from the inversion of the fundamental mode of Love and Rayleigh waves. And you can see that in this model, we see already the gross picture of the Earth. We see, for example, that the middle, the fast anisotropic directions, which are supposed to give the flow if the anisotropy is due to the latest preferred orientation of olivine crystal or for anisotropic crystals. The fast anisotropic directions are in general perpendicular to the ridge axis. You can see that in SV wave heterogeneities, we find a very strong correlation with surface tectonics, mid-oceanic ridges, low velocities, high velocity beneath quaternions, and that this disappears with depth. And for the radial anisotropy, I will often discuss this parameter, which is Xi. It has been shown yesterday by Hannah too, and it's the SH velocity on the SV velocity at the square. And this radial anisotropy is often interpreted in terms of mantle flow, and in the upper mantle, often with when SH is faster than SV, we assume that there is horizontal flow, that it's indicative of horizontal flow, and when SH is lower than SV, we assume that this is due to horizontal flow. And you can see that basically at 70 or 100 kilometers depth, the anisotropy is blue here, which means that SH is faster than SV, so it's more horizontal flow. And there are some indications of negative perturbation in Xi beneath continents at 100 kilometers depth. Fine. So this was the gross picture of the Earth 25 years ago. Now we are trying to improve on that. And to do that, there has been two main developments in the last 25 years. First, we have much more data. Okay, so and we have developed automated approaches to process this data. And in the model of Jean-Paul, there was a few thousands of seismograms, but now we are able to model in an automated way millions of waveforms. Okay. And the second thing is that on each seismogram, we have developed some techniques that allow us to extract more information from the seismograms. In Jean-Paul's model, the model was based on the dominant part of the surface wave seismogram, which is called the fundamental mode, but we can now process the waveforms and process the higher modes of surface waves, and in the period range in which we work with the fundamental mode, you constrain mostly the first uppermost 300 kilometers of the mantle, but with the higher mode, you get resolution down to the bottom of the upper mantle. Okay, and finally, we model the waveform, and when you model the waveform, you can model the phase of the seismograms, but also the amplitude. And from the phase of the seismograms, you will get an information of the shear wave velocity structure. It can be SV or SH, depending on whether you process a Rayleigh or a Love waves. But when you model the amplitude, you can also get an information on the quality factor. So the idea is to apply all the models that you will see in the future of this talk, in the next part of this talk, are built using this waveform inversion approach. And the idea is to apply it to thousands or millions of seismograms, in general, we get this kind of ray density maps with high density in the northern hemisphere, lower density in the southern hemisphere, but a lot of redundant data. It's typical of what we can do in global modern surface tomography now. And then we can produce some shear velocity model and azimuthal anisotropy model that indicate the mantle flow if we process the Rayleigh waves. If we process the Rayleigh waves and the Love wave and we invert them at depth, we can produce the radial anisotropy model. And finally, from the amplitude of the Rayleigh waves, we can get some information on the quality factor. So let's start with the shear wave heterogeneities. So this model is called 3D2016-03SV. It's our latest seismic model. Now it's automatically updated every 3 months. We follow the publication of the CMT catalog and we put the model online on my web page or as a high-risk data product. So the model currently is based on 1.4 million of waveforms roughly. It includes azimuthal anisotropy and fundamental mode and higher modes. So if you look at this model, I will not describe that in details because it's very well known, the correlation with surface tectonics in the permost 200 kilometers, and then a more simple organization within the transition zone with high velocities that concentrate in a broad region in the subduction in Indonesia and around the Pacific Ocean. But something that is interesting is the fact that if you look at the map at 50 kilometers, you can see that in oceanic regions, the clearly dominant signal is the mid-oceanic ridges, and basically when you go away from the ridge, you get fast velocity. I point that out because you will see that in attenuation at 50 kilometers depth, when I will show the map later, it's a bit different. Okay, so now what's happening if we take this model and we average the shear wave heterogeneities globally? So this is an average of the shear wave velocity in your seismic velocity model as a function of the age. And you can see that this is for oceanic region, Phanerozoic, Proterozoic, and Archean. And you can see that we pick up very well the low velocity asthenosphere, which has a thickness down to 200 kilometers depth with low velocity regions. We pick up very well the thickening of the oceanic lithosphere, and the black line here represents the thickness of the lithosphere in the Hall space cooling model. So thickening as a square root of the age, and it fits very well with the observations. And finally, there is another thing that we pick up quite well is the fact that the high velocity beneath the craton, the Proterozoic and the Archean, is much thicker. It extends down to 200, 250, maybe 200, and it's much thicker than in oceanic regions. Fine. Let's do the same thing now for the azimuthal anisotropy. This is the strength of the azimuthal anisotropy because we can invert for that in this kind of model. And you can see that this azimuthal anisotropy is quite strong within the asthenosphere. It's the layer where we find the strongest azimuthal anisotropy. It seems that it depends also with the square root of the age. We have some indication of this. And there is something that is interesting, is the fact that if you compare the depth extent of the azimuthal anisotropy beneath oceanic regions and beneath Precambrian regions, it's not much different. It seems that there is no clear difference in the depth extent of azimuthal anisotropy beneath oceanic regions and Precambrian regions. Now, we have looked at the strengths of the azimuthal anisotropy. Let's look at the azimuthal anisotropy as a function of plate velocity. So the dashed line is the same thing as on the previous slide. It's the strength of the azimuthal anisotropy, but average for different plate velocity. And you can see that roughly, they are mostly horizontal, except this one maybe. So it seems that whether you are on a slow plate or on a fast plate, you have the same amount of azimuthal anisotropy. But it seems that the azimuthal anisotropy decreases with depth from 2% at 100 kilometers depth to 0.7% at 300 kilometers. It's what we have seen on the previous slide. Now, if we look at the part of the azimuthal anisotropy that align with the plate motion, this is the solid lines here, you can see that the situation is completely different. For slow plates, we see that almost no portion of the anisotropy align with the plate motion. But between 3 and 5 centimeters per year, the anisotropy starts to align with plate motion, and then it saturates. And the maximum of aligned anisotropy is observed at 150 and 200 kilometers depth. It is weaker in the oceanic, in the lithosphere, oceanic or continental, and then it decreases with depth at greater depth. From this figure, which has been updated with our latest model, we suggested with Yannick Ricard in 2013 that only the plates that move faster than about 4 centimeters per year can produce sufficient shearing at their base to organize the anisotropy at large scale. And we can see that in a much better way if we plot the anisotropy projected on the absolute plate motion as on maps. So on the left, the maps that are faster, that the plates that are faster than 4 centimeters per year, the threshold value that we have seen on the previous slide. On the right, the plates that are slower than 4 centimeters per year. And you can see that the blue regions correspond to the region where the anisotropy correlates with the absolute plate motion, the red regions where the anisotropy does not correlate with the absolute plate motion. You can see that the blue region covers young oceanic region at 50 kilometers depth. When you go deeper, you move below the plate, and the part of anisotropy that correlates well with the plate motion start to cover entirely at 150 kilometers the oceanic plate, and then at 200 kilometers Australia. And India, it starts a bit earlier. And for the fast, so it seems that there is really a large scale process at the scale of the entire plate that organize the anisotropy. But then when you look at the slower plates, the maps are patchy. There are some regions, some broad scale regions where the anisotropy correlates with the plate motion, but never at the scale of the entire plate tectonic. Right. Finally, if we go at larger depths, it's the same thing. We lose the organization, the large scale organization at 250 kilometers depth for the fast moving plate. And they, after the maps become patchy. And for slow moving plates, the maps stay really patchy. So there is really something different in azimuthal anisotropy between fast and slow plates. We can plot that as a cross section as a function of the age. This is the angular difference between absolute plate motion and azimuthal anisotropy. For fast plate, you see these regions which correspond to the oceanic asthenosphere where the anisotropy agree with the plate motion. It seems that it depends roughly with the square root of the age. For slow plate, we see not much. Okay? So this is for the azimuthal anisotropy. Now let's have a look at the radial anisotropy. So if we do that, this work has been done, so it's a work of TAC O in Cambridge. So TAC has taken 400,000 Love and Rayleigh waves. They have exactly the same coverage. Okay, with the Love wave, we built an SH model. With a Rayleigh wave, we built an SV model. And from that, we rebuilt the radial anisotropy model, used fundamental mode and overtones. We are working at a bit longer period compared to the XAI model that you have seen and that have been shown yesterday by Anna Ferreira. And the idea is to avoid to be too much sensitive to the crust. And we use the best crustal model that we have. And when we do that, you can see that shallow depth, pretty much, it looks pretty much like the model by Jean-Paul. SH is roughly faster than SV. So it means horizontal flow. Keep in mind that in the lithosphere at 70 kilometers, the flow is probably frozen. At 100 kilometers depth, it seems that we have a negative anisotropy with size smaller than one beneath many continents, and this may indicate that the structure that is frozen is a vertical flow. And finally, when you go at greater depth, what is interesting is the fact that at 250 kilometers depth here, and at 300 kilometers, I'm not sure if you see it very well here, but you see that we have some indication of negative azimuthal anisotropy, negative size smaller than one, and this would indicate deep upwelling beneath mid-oceanic ridges. And if we play the same exercise and for the SV velocity, if we average the Xi as a function of the age, we recover that. There are a few interesting things. So this negative azimuthal anisotropy beneath mid-oceanic ridges. The Xi that organized in a strong layer of anisotropy with the top at 80 kilometers, 100 kilometers, and the bottom between 150 and 200 kilometers. There is something that is very interesting here, is that the layer is flat, dominantly flat. It seems that to a large extent, it's not really something that is deepening with the square root of the LH, at least for the maximum anisotropy. And then there is something else that we recover the negative anisotropy beneath continents between 100 and 250 kilometers. And there is something that is very different from the azimuthal anisotropy, is the fact that between 250 kilometers and 350 kilometers, we find SH that is faster than SV for radial anisotropy. So it seems that the radial anisotropy extends much deeper beneath Precambrian cratons than beneath oceanic regions. Now, this was the result for fast and slow moving plate for the azimuthal anisotropy. We have done the same exercise for the radial anisotropy. You can see that for azimuthal anisotropy, the situation is very different between the fast and the slow moving plate. For radial anisotropy, there are some differences, but they are mostly minor. It means that we've got a slightly stronger anisotropy maybe beneath the fast moving plate, but mostly in both cases, the layers are horizontal, and then you've got a deeper anisotropy beneath the cratons. Okay? How can we explain that? So we've got the idea, the observations that we make are very consistent, in fact, with a model that was a conceptual model that was published 1 year ago by Hauer and co-authors. And the idea is quite simple, is the fact that the azimuthal anisotropy that we observe that deepens with the square root of the H here is probably due to shearing LPO anisotropy at the bottom of the plate. Okay, but the radial anisotropy that is flat may be due to the pocket of melt that will accumulate at in a layer which is located due to higher melt mobility between in a layer between 150 and 100. Located between 150 and 60 kilometers depth. And in fact, this idea comes from the experimental result of Sakamaki and co-authors in 2013. And here we observe in the paper, they suggest that the top of the layer will be between 80 and 100 kilometers is roughly what we observe. But the idea is that the melt accumulate at the bottom, in pockets at the bottom of the layer, it is taken by the plate when the plate spread out laterally, and it produces a shape preferred orientation of pocket frills that are eventually frozen within the lithosphere that we can see here. This will produce a shape preferred orientation, but if there is no preferred azimuthal orientation of the pocket, it will not contribute strongly to the azimuthal anisotropy. And finally, in a region where you have hot spots, it could be reworked. Then, if we come back to the depth extent of radial anisotropy, you probably all know this paper by Gung and Romanovich in 2003, where they found from a radial anisotropy that SH is faster than SV beneath continents in this depth range between 200 and 250 kilometers. It's faster than in oceanic regions, and this was interpreted as shearing at the bottom of the plate. And we obtained exactly the same results from the radial anisotropy. We find SH faster than SV in this depth range, and the radial anisotropy beneath continental regions, oceanic regions, so is shallower. But the idea, you can see also that the depth extent of the radial anisotropy extends deeper than the base of the SV velocity, so this suggests that there is anisotropy that will be due to the anisotropic crystals that will be preferentially in the horizontal plane. But when we look at the azimuthal anisotropy, there is no clear difference between fast and slow velocity plate. So we need to explain some radial anisotropy with horizontal flow here, but no azimuthal anisotropy. And in fact, this is possible if the anisotropic crystals are preferentially in the horizontal plane, but if they are azimuthally or random at large scale. In this case, you do not expect azimuthal anisotropy. So to summarize, for the anisotropy part, the radial anisotropy extends deeper beneath continents than beneath oceanic regions. And we see this layer in radial anisotropy between 200 and 250 kilometers. This suggests horizontal flow. But there is no Ocean continent difference in the depth extent of azimuthal anisotropy. So maybe between 200 and 250 kilometers, the anisotropic crystals are preferentially oriented in the horizontal plane, but azimuthally random at very large scale. And this is consistent with the idea that only the plates that are faster than 4 centimeters per year organize the anisotropy at large scale, as most continents except Australia and India are located on plates which are slower than 4 centimeters per year. And then we have a shape preferred orientation of a melt pocket that could explain the flat radial anisotropy, as was previously suggested. And we also observe broad region of vertical flow beneath mid-oceanic ridges between 200 and 250 kilometers. Okay, now let's have a look at the quality factor. So this is a work on my PhD student, Alissa Denis. So she works with a database that we have built with Yannick Ricard in 2012 for the fundamental mode and the higher mode, a global dataset. We produced a set of attenuation curves for Rayleigh waves. We invert for the logarithm of Q for practical reasons, is avoid to get negative value of the quality factor. When you process the amplitude of seismograms, you have to be very careful because the amplitude is affected by a lot of effects that that are not taken into account by a simple theory, so you have to correct for that. So what we do is that the most important effect is the focusing, defocusing of waves, and there is a formalism that was developed by Woodhouse and Wong in 86, so we use that to correct from this effect. We have also to be very careful about the source excitation, so the data that are close to a node in the radiation pattern, we reject that because the amplitude at the source may be wrong and it could introduce a bias in our inverted model. When we suspect that there is an instrument problem or a scalar seismic problem moment, we reject the data and we reject the outliers. So we start with 250,000 waveforms, we end up with 40,000 waveforms at the end, 40,000 paths at the end, and we invert that. So what you see is, here is a model that is inverted at depth, so it's a S-wave quality factor as a function of depth. And what you can see at the top, it's quite interesting, is that, you know, at 50 kilometers, 100 and 150 kilometers depth, roughly what we see, the most significant signal is the difference between ocean and continent. So continents have low attenuation, oceans have higher attenuations. We see quite well the strong attenuation signature of mid-oceanic ridges. In the Pacific, Indian Ocean, and in the Atlantic. We find it again down to 100 or 150 kilometers depth. But there is something that is different compared to the shear velocity map that I showed at the beginning of the talk. It's the fact that on the shear velocity map, we had high velocity everywhere. And here you can see that we have strong attenuation anomalies that are located often in the vicinity of hotspots, in fact, not always, but that are located in old oceanic regions. And if we go at larger depths, we see that it's especially clear in the Pacific or in the southern Indian Ocean, the AFAR, we see that this strong attenuation anomalies seems to locate, this is very clear beneath Hawaii, for example, in the vicinities of some hotspots. Fine. So now, We can play the same game as we have done for the other models. We can try to avoid this quality factor model as a function of the age, and this is what we get. We find a strong attenuating signal for oceanic lithosphere between 20 and 80 million years. It seems that there is a kind of thickening as a square root of the age. Here we've got a stronger, weaker attenuation. This could be due to subductions. But if you look, it's not so simple than in the velocity signal. You can see that, for example, there are some anomalies here, which probably correspond to the anomalies that we observed on the maps. And if we compare that to the shear velocity signal, you can see that the signal is much more simple in shear velocity. And there is also something else that is interesting. It's the fact that the lithosphere, as it is defined by the weak attenuation layer, seems to be a bit thinner in attenuation than in velocity. So this may suggest that if we see mostly a thermal signal, that we see here a thermal lithosphere, and that the deep part of the route that we observe in shear velocity is in fact mostly due to depletion or compositional heterogeneity, that it was suggested by Jordan for the tectosphere hypothesis. So we may see here a thermal lithosphere and here a tectosphere, which is a bit more thick. And finally, you can see that the attenuation signal has a stronger, there are some anomalies compared to the simple square root thickening of the lithosphere, and probably this may suggest that the attenuation is more sensitive to temperature and the lithosphere may be. Then what we have tried to do is to be a bit more quantitative, and we have computed the correlation between our shear velocity and our attenuation models as a function of spherical harmonic degrees. And the lower colors, I'm not sure if you see well here, but there's three curves here correspond to depth of 100 and between 100 and 150 kilometers. And you see that the correlation is very good at this depth. Okay, so there is a common component in both signals. But if we look at 50, 70, and 90 kilometers depth for very low spherical harmonic degrees, we have an anticorrelation that starts to disappear between 90 and 100 kilometers. And if we want to understand the reason of this anticorrelation, we can just take our phase, attenuation and our shear velocity map, and we filter out, we remove the short wavelength component, so these maps contain only the first, second, and third spherical harmonic degrees. And you understand immediately why the maps do not correlate. In attenuation, we see a very strong long wavelength anomaly attenuation, which extends to from Hawaii to the East Pacific rise, and it's a dominant anomaly with one in the Indian Ocean. Whether in shear velocity at shallow depth, the dominant anomalies are located beneath the East Pacific rise and the Indonesia and eastern part of Asia. And then when we move at 150 kilometers, the maps become similar. So it seems that we need to explain this high attenuation here with strong attenuation anomaly with maybe higher velocities. So one way to do that in a very simple way, I'm not a special, I have one more minute and it's finished. One way to explain that in a very simple way is to assume that it's a thermal plume. If attenuation is more sensitive to temperature than shear velocity, you could explain that you have this strong attenuation anomaly in this part of the map. This was suggested by Romanovich and Gung in 2002 in the Pacific Asthenosphere, and this is their map at 300 kilometers. This is our filtered map at 200 kilometers. We do not agree everywhere, but we agree for the idea of a deep source near the Samoa hotspot. And then, so it could be that thermal upwelling that is deflected horizontally beneath the lithosphere, but if it is true, the fact that we have a very strong anomaly with a very long wavelength component suggests that there are probably several plumes in the Pacific that deflect horizontally at the bottom of the lithosphere. Okay, and this is quite consistent with the radial anisotropy that we observe at 100 kilometers depth. Here you've got a very strong radial anisotropy in the South Pacific, which extends from Hawaii to the East Pacific rise, which is underlined at 300 kilometers by SH slower than SV, which is indicative of upwelling in the upper mountain. Okay. Now, then it's a bit more adventurous, but there are some other regions where we have reduced velocities and moderately weak attenuation. And in these regions, for example, it's the case here in the eastern part of the Pacific. So maybe, it's not very clear to me, but it has been suggested from mechanical experiments that if melt is present, it may reduce velocity without affecting the attenuation. This was proposed, for example, for the East Pacific rise, and this may provide an explanation for this kind of observation. So I go to a summary of a presentation, the attenuation part. So the broad attenuation anomaly in the Central Pacific will result from several thermal upwelling deflected horizontally in the Pacific asthenosphere. It's compatible with the radial anisotropy. And maybe partial melt provide an explanation for some regions where low velocity are associated with moderate or high Q. Thank you very much. I leave it here.